This Week in Law is coming up next, and joining us today is Stuart Baker, formerly of the Department of Homeland Security and the NSA, now of the wonderful realm of Podcastia, along with us here on This Week in Law. My co-hosts Stefan Spida and Matt Curtis are with me as well. And in this episode, we're hacking back at the EU, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, FISA, and rogue vending machines, all this and more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiLT.
This is TWiLT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Stefan Spida, and Matt Curtis. Episode 434, recorded September 14th, 2018. Han Solo hacks back. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. My goodness, we've got a treat of a show for you today. I am so excited about our guest, who I am going to introduce forthwith. He is the former Department of Homeland Security Assistant Secretary and the former General Counsel for the NSA, now a partner at the Steptoe & Johnson firm in Washington, D.C., author, commentator, and podcaster in his own right, Stuart Baker is joining us today. Hi, Stuart. Great to have you.
Hi, Denise. It's great to be on. I'm a longtime fan. First time appearing.
Yes, it's wonderful to have you on our show. I'm a huge fan of your show as well, the Cyber Law Podcast, which if you're a fan of our show, you're going to love Stuart's show too.
Yep, it's been a lot of fun to do. It's very Washington focused and cyber security focused. So it's a nice complement to the work that you've been doing for so long.
Thank you. Yeah, it definitely is a fascinating show. I'm always thrilled to find a show that gets even wonkier than ours does, and I'd say yours qualifies. That's not an easy thing to do. Also joining us today are my two fabulous co-hosts. Stefan Spida is here from the Dorsey firm in Seattle, Washington. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, Denise. Hi, everyone. I'm very glad to be here today with such a distinguished guest on such a topical subject matter. Looking forward to learning as much as I can today.
I know, me as well. Also, here is Matt Curtis. Hi, Matt. Great to see you.
Great to see everyone. This is, a bit about outside of my wheelhouse, but got a deep dive into FISA this week and looking to learn some more.
Oh, goodness. Well, you'll have to tell us what you did learn this week about FISA, because probably for most of us, FISA is something of a black box. I think intentionally so. All right. So let's get right into it. We're going to start out this week with stories about crimes and justice. So out here, we mentioned the differences between the Cyber Law Podcast and This Week in Law, one being that Stuart's show is much more focused and very deep dives on things that relate to cybersecurity, national security, et cetera. And that out here on the West Coast, when we talk about deep fakes, the people who are most concerned about it generally are the celebrities. But when we're going to talk about it today, it's in the context of the fact that several U.S. lawmakers are concerned about this issue. They sent a letter yesterday to National Intelligence Director Dan Coats asking about the potential impact of deepfakes on democracy and national security. So very big issues. The concern there is, you know, as if fake news stories on social media were not of sufficient concern as far as changing the mood and opinion of the public at large in large swaths. If this phenomenon then moves to a video format, we've all come to trust our eyes and ears so much when we see photographs and videos of things, or maybe we haven't in today's day and age, or maybe parts of the population do and are more savvy than others. But these congresspeople are concerned about the deep fake issue and want to know what the government basically is going to do about it. Stuart, can you tell us a bit more about your take on deep fakes?
Yeah, I mean, deep fakes are generally a generally very serious problem because faking video is already pretty good. AI and it makes it even better. And these kinds of tools never get worse. So we're going to see democratization of faking video to the point where it'll be very hard to tell what's real and what's not. This is something that people have worried about generally in the tech community for a few years in the context of fake revenge porn. But in order to get Congress to do something about it, we've got to stop talking about fake porn and start talking about political scandals, because that's what will actually get their attention. And so asking the intelligence community to tell the Congress, what could an adversary nation do with deepfake technology? How bad could it be? I think is a good recipe for Congress taking this threat pretty seriously.
It is. And just given your background, knowledge, experience, and security clearances, Stuart, can you give us some speculation as to how you foresee these kinds of tools being used for bad purposes?
Well, sure. Maybe we'll discover that the Golden Showers dossier was real, at least according to some faked up video from the Russians. If they decide that Trump isn't delivering for them, they could always produce something like that. Or they could destroy a particular politician running for office just because they think that that politician is a real danger to them, and not just the Russians. The Iranians could decide that there's a particular congressman they want to destroy, and they produce something that appears to show the person engaged in sexual harassment or some other unsavory activity, and it'll be very hard to undo the damage that that tape does, even if 3 months later we discover it's a fake.
Stefan, it seems to me like there's some crossover here, not just, you know, between the news and policy and security side of this equation, but also, of course, as Stuart mentioned, between people's identities being used for purposes that they wouldn't otherwise approve of. Do you see Congress getting involved in that issue too, or do you think Stuart's right that we've got to frame this as a national security issue to get them to pay attention?
I think as a practical matter, Stuart's probably right, because to get somebody to care about something, you have to make it personal. And in this case, if you impact Congress's livelihood by generating scandals, or at least creating the possibility that scandals are going to start impacting them directly in this meaningful way, that I think as a practical matter is going to get them to care about it. One thing that I find interesting is the conversation is framed around assuming that the videos are fake and the impact that might cause. You could even have a negative impact by just having the videos out there from the other side. So, for example, if there are known fake videos that are floating around, you might show a real video, and a congressman could say, "Well, hold on a second, I didn't do that. That's a fake video." And I think it could much more likely to cause damage in that way, because what we've seen over the past couple of years is true stories being dismissed as fake, and people believing that true stories are fake, and that erosion of credibility and that doubting of what is real and what is fake can happen even when the underlying material is in fact real. And so I think this really strikes at the heart of what does it mean to tell the truth in the public setting? And I think that's an unresolved issue in public discourse. And so that's where the sensitivities are, and that's where the real potential for damage lies right now.
Yeah, I'm already seeing that in practice where, you know, it's increasingly a tactic on the part of nation states to figure out who their enemies in the U.S. Establishment are and break into their email and then dox them to the newspapers. And they're sort of competing hacks going on in the Persian Gulf of everybody's favorite lobbyist in Washington. And the Russians, because the Russians did that and then faked some video, some of the emails, the reporters I talked to are never sure whether the emails they've been leaked that are purportedly hacked from a particular Washington player are completely real. They might be 98% real, but the 2% is where the scandal is supposed to be. And reporters are stuck. They don't know whether to report those stories or how enthusiastically to report those stories, even as we speak. And that's before deepfake videos really make an impression.
It seems to me like over the last several years, as people have become aware how easy it is to manipulate photographs, and now we're talking about manipulating video, that tools have become available, you know, the cat and mouse game of, okay, we've made a fake. Okay, we're able to debunk what you've done and show that it's fake. That's gotten fairly sophisticated with photographs. Stuart, do you think that we're anywhere near as close on the video front?
I think the same process is going to occur. That's going to be an arms race. There will always be a little bit better technology to find fakes, but every time you find a fake, you're going to find it using software and AI tools, and thus the people who want to have a really convincing fake will ask, how did they tell that was fake? And their AI will analyze the AI that's finding the fakes and figure out ways to fix that. So I think it'll, as an arms race, it'll quickly get beyond the ability of amateurs to tell whether something is fake or not. And, you know, we may have to go to a system in which the people who make video cameras automatically put in some anti-forgery watermarking and hashing tools so that you can say at least we have a pretty good idea when and where this was produced and by whom and what camera, so that there are some indicia of accuracy and realism beyond just what you see on the screen.
Yeah, that sounds like it could open a whole can of worms. Yes. Are you envisioning legislation that would require camera makers of all kinds, whether they're on a phone or a security camera? I mean, our cameras are everywhere now. Implement that kind of technology?
Obviously, there are going to be hearings. People have to figure out what the consequences of that and there are privacy implications for it, although you could probably design the technology so only the manufacturer could decrypt and the information. But yeah, I think if you want to be sure that something that was produced on what appears to be an iPhone is actually good video, I think iPhone is going to have to take some measures to make sure that what pictures are taken are the pictures that are displayed.
Yeah, that sounds like a big old stay tuned on this front, that could be a shoe that drops as a result of this letter that the Congress people have sent this week. Matt, what's your take on how people's skepticism level is these days? Do you feel like people are easily duped or no?
I think it's a hard to in any time to like cross-reference what you feel this time to another time. But I would say at least publicly, there's more announcements now that, you know, there's more falsity and there's more claims of falsity than I think I remember, at least. And I think that's pretty well documented. I think that this problem, though, of a deepfake of a video, if you think that making a deepfake of a video is as easy or as technically easy for some people, for a nation state, for example, is as easy as forging a document or making a false allegation, then I think that you have to look at when you're making policy is what have we done in those instances in terms of faking a document or going in false, you know, creating a false acquisition or false accusation. And I think that like there's almost nothing from a technical level or from a procedural level that's going to be able to stop this from happening. Part of that is just the nature of the news cycle is that before anyone even knows that it's wrong, so maybe you know it's gone 2 weeks ago, but you know, 80% of your news viewers aren't going to see that second, you know, confirmation that this was wrong, and the 20% that do, or you know, that's great, but your news cycle has already flashed, and if you're leading up to an election, then your election's already happened. So I think that I think that this is a problem and going to be a problem, and there's probably not that much that Congress can do if you look at an analog to just lying about, you know, where someone was, because there's not something that like you can stop. And I think that technically, you know, when we think about putting videos with some sort of mark, videos are something that, and cameras themselves last much longer than any other technology that we have. You know, you look at your local gas station, it's got cameras from 10 years ago. And so the latency problem of that is going to mean that you can fake them even if you passed a law saying that all cameras going forward have to have this technical embellishment. You know, you're still going to get them passed there. So I think it's in terms of how skeptical we are of the news that comes before us, that seems like a problem that is in videos as much as is in anything else. And it's not a great situation. I'm just not sure that there's an easy solution.
So no, very little of what we're going to discuss today has an easy solution. Stuart, what were you going to say?
It's worth remembering what the Macron campaign did in France to insulate themselves from Russian hacking and Russian doxing of the candidate. They salted their email files with fake emails that they wrote that they knew they could disprove. Sure enough, the Russians did break in, did steal the emails, did publicize the emails that Macron wanted them to publicize, and Macron was able to immediately show that that couldn't possibly have happened because the guy who was supposed to have sent the email was someplace else entirely, and it destroyed the Russian campaign. So you could imagine campaigns starting to put together their own fake videos just in case they need to demonstrate how easy it is to make fake videos of people doing things they shouldn't do.
Yeah, that was brilliant. Now it seems like a good time to talk about the steps that the administration has taken this week to help ensure that our elections are not interfered with in the way the 2016 ones were. Can you bring us up to speed there, Stuart?
Yeah, what the president did was issued an executive order that said, I want my DNI to evaluate each election and let me know within, I think, 45 days of the election, let the nation know if there has been interference by any nation. And then we're going to retaliate, and it relies on existing authorities to lay out the retaliation options. And so it is I wouldn't say it broke new ground. None of this is something that the president couldn't have done anyway. And there is some speculation that he did it because he wanted to head off something that would have been more automatic and a little more focused on Russia. But it is, you know, from the point of view of protecting our democracy, it's better than not having done it, because it demonstrates that the president, for all of his friendliness to Putin, is willing to say he's going to retaliate. And there are plenty of people around him who would be eager to retaliate. So my guess is that if there is interference with the election, there will be more consequences from the United States aimed at the state that tries to do it.
What is that retaliation going to look like?
Well, unfortunately, the menu of options is not long. We're not going to fire nuclear missiles. The things that we have done in the past, we have indicted members of the intelligence services of several countries now for breaking into systems and in some cases trying to interfere with the election or our national discourse. That's great once. It's okay two or three times. People call it naming and shaming. But I think the more you do it without actually doing anything other than say shame on you, it invokes that old story that says, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. I fear that if we keep indicting people without doing anything other than that, we will just look ineffectual. And then maybe with more effect, the Treasury Department has an ability to cut off financial transactions with named persons, named entities, whole nations, if they chose. And those penalties are really quite strong and surprisingly unilateral. If the United States says we are sanctioning this particular oligarch, don't do business with him on penalty of violating U.S. law, even European banks, probably even Chinese banks, are going to be very reluctant to do business with that person or to even let him have access to his money. So if you watch what the people around Putin and Putin himself have objected to most strenuously in U.S. policy, it is past sanctions. And that tells you that that's something that they worry about. But it's not a perfectly tuned weapon. They tried to say, we're going to take the entire intelligence service, the FSB in Russia, and tell people you can't do business with them. And then they discovered that the FSB oversaw the granting of licenses to use encryption inside Russia. And every company in the United States that did business there was already doing business with the FSB and needed an exception. The sanctions, the effort to impose sanctions often has unanticipated consequences. So those are the things we do now. I have been arguing we ought to do a lot more and that it ought to be much uglier and much more aggressive because it has to be something that actually scares the Russians. And I don't think indictments do. And I think they've gotten used to sanctions.
Yeah, I think we're going to talk quite a bit about hacking back later in the show. Is that what you have in mind or something more on the economic and policy side?
So no, hacking back is something that a company might do, and we can talk about that. That's highly controversial and illegal right now. I'm thinking more of things the U.S. government could do. And the question is, are there things we could do outside of the cyber realm? I was a strong advocate for saying that our retaliation against Sony for trying to stop the distribution of the interview would be to put the interview on a million SIM cards, attach the SIM cards to helium balloons, and let them go downwind of North Korea so that everybody in North Korea could see that stupid movie. I'm not sure whether that's an advantage for freedom or a penalty for living in North Korea. But at any rate, you know that the ruling class in North Korea would have hated that maybe more than anything because it's a kind of Streisand effect for international affairs. Oh, you really don't want this movie out, huh? How about we give it to every one of your citizens?
Got it. Hey, Stefan, anything you want to add or ask Stuart about on the front of election security?
I kind of laughed to myself when you mentioned the hacking back point because, you know, the whole problem with election interference only arises if you have a fair election to begin with. Hacking back at Putin's coronation is not going to be the most effective way of delegitimizing a process that is, you know, probably not very legitimate to begin with. So I guess my question is, Stuart mentioned that the oligarchs are getting used to sanctions. What are some of the things they've been doing to get around sanctions? And is there anything that can be done to make the sanctions effective again? Or you might say great again.
Yeah. So my sense on this is that first, if they keep their money in Russia, then it's hard for the U.S. Treasury to reach it there. Now, many of these oligarchs don't want to do that. If they've bought property through companies that are shells, and we don't know that there's a connection between the sanctioned party and the entity that's carried out the transaction, then they can continue to keep those assets safely. Ironically, the best place to set up a shell corporation with anonymous ownership is Delaware, followed by Wyoming and Nevada. Most of the other countries in the world have adopted much stricter rules about identifying who the beneficial owner of a particular company is. So, yeah, you could do more inside the United States and perhaps in some of the other countries that have not gotten on board with Know Your Customer rules pursuing folks as they travel from country to country and actually delaying their travel or maybe even extraditing them is another possibility, assuming that you can find a violation of sanctions law to charge them with.
Matt, anything you want to add or ask about election security before we move on?
No, just questions in terms of preventative measures. Are there any things that you've seen that like seem like there's any possibility of a prevention of this other than just a deterrent?
So there is a report out now from the National Academy of Sciences that I think we're going to cover, and we can turn to that now because they're talking about how to prevent foreign governments from interfering in the actual election machinery and technology. And it's a pretty good report. It's pretty thoughtful. And it basically says, yeah, give up your computers. Mark your ballots with pen, and maybe you can count them with an optical reader. But basically, everybody ought to be using paper, and you ought to have mechanisms for doing an audit of the election afterwards, just to confirm for yourself that no changes were made to these ballots. This is the first, but maybe not the last, place where we're going to fall out of love with technology and start moving back to older technologies that worked fine and weren't hackable.
Yes, I forget which state I just read about this morning or yesterday morning was touting that it had reinstated a paper trail for its electronic voting machines. And it does seem like paper has become the new high-tech thing in voting as far as integrity and security goes. So we can expect to see more of that, it seems like, from as a result of this report from the National Academies of Sciences. Is there anything else we should know about what they had to say, Stuart?
I thought that was the main takeaway, that they really just didn't see there was a way to fix the technology or that it was worth the expenditure of enormous effort to on machines that people don't pay a lot of money for and roll out every 2 years at most. At some point, you just say, wow, why don't we just get a piece of paper and some pens? I'm going to interview Chris Krebs, who is the head of DHS's cybersecurity unit, a week or two before the election to do an update. So if you're interested in that, probably about a month from now, we'll have an interview on the Cyber Law podcast of him.
Oh, that's wonderful. We'll definitely wait for that. And right now, your current episode of the Cyber Law podcast has Bruce Schneier, another wonderful person to talk about on security issues. And I did listen to that episode start to finish, and I've got to say it was pretty chilling.
Yeah, he's a very smart guy, and he's moved from just doing technology to thinking about the policy issues, and he's moved on policy issues from being a kind of John Perry Barlow enthusiast for you know, the demise of the republics of iron and steel, to saying, you know, maybe there are some problems here in cyberspace that we can only solve with regulation. Oddly, after years of disagreeing with each other on almost everything, we're starting to agree on this fundamental problem, which is that we do not know how to solve the cybersecurity problem, and it's going to kill people if we don't solve it. Since going down the road we're going down just seems to make things worse, we're going to need to find a way to get an off-ramp. And regulation for all of the problems, and no one thinks that it's lacking in problems, for all those problems, it may be our best bet.
Yeah, absolutely. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact, and folks listening to this episode, whenever they listen to it, since our archives live as long as they possibly can live online, should know that we are recording this during 9/11 week. And that is much on our minds as we go through these issues. And it was much on my mind when I listened to your interview with Bruce Schneier. And one of the things I wanted to ask you as a follow-up to that was if you thought that the kinds of threats, the sort of existential terrible threats that we might be facing today look like the ones that we did in September 2001, or if they look a whole lot different.
So they do look different. But when I finished up at DHS, I wrote a book about both 9/11 and what it meant for the future, and the technology that enabled 9/11, which you don't think of as dramatic, but it was, and what other kinds of problems we might have. It was called Skating on Stilts, to convey my sense that you know, we're going faster, but we're not necessarily more stable. What happened with 9/11 at a very macro level is that we went from having people arrive on sailing ships in numbers that people could inspect and look at their luggage, inspect the people. You could have folks at each port and decide, is this somebody I want to let in, read their paperwork, go through their stuff, and make that decision, to a world in which mass air transportation made it so fast and so easy for people to travel that they started traveling in numbers that almost approached Moore's law in terms of doubling, not every 2 years, but every 10 years, international travel doubled for 40 or 50 years. And what happened was that the people at the border were just overwhelmed with that. They had to let them in because they were mostly tourists. They were mostly good for the economy. People were worried a little bit about illegal immigration, but not that much with people from well-to-do countries. And so they just started waving people in. They had 30 seconds to make a decision and nothing to make it on. And so the answer was always yes. And that's how the hijackers got into the country. We had never invested in doing electronic background checks to have to use available information to find out whether these were folks that we should be suspicious of. And after 9/11, we turned to a bunch of things that gave us basic information about the people who are coming in, and that was part of our defenses. I think the same thing is happening with cybersecurity, where Moore's law mostly expands the attack surface, doubles the attack surface. As computing gets cheaper, we put it into more and more stuff, and using Linux on an old 386 model is practically free. And so why not add it to your dishwasher, your dryer, et cetera? And if the dryer turns around and starts DDoSing somebody, you won't even know and you won't care. As long as it was cheap enough, it doesn't matter to you that somebody else is suffering from the insecurity of your devices. So it does seem to me that we're going to see constantly expanding threats that people will use more creatively every year. And until we recognize that and come up with the equivalent of doing electronic background checks on travelers, we are not going to address this problem in a serious way.
Right. And as you point out, electronic hygiene on all of these devices, you know, whether it's an Internet of Things device or, as you say, some database living on some older computer running older software. We have a story in our rundown for this week about the, and I may not pronounce this right, Aadhaar software that was hacked in India. It's an identity database which contains biometrics and personal information of over a billion Indians. And it's now been compromised. So although, you know, no one is, you could see down the road how having access to a billion people's identity information is quite a problem.
And it's a fascinating story because this is the identity document. Many people in India don't have any identity document. It was considered a big breakthrough to give them an identity document that wasn't easily forged so that they could get benefits, food, and the like. That means that if you have one of these cards, you can get benefits. If you don't have one of these cards, you're a nobody. So people who are operating on the margins or people who want to have two rations instead of one were enthusiastic about getting into the system, not to steal the data of others, but to just forge a bunch of cards. And what it turns out they did is they actually created a patch to the software that is used to enroll people in the system. And the patch allows anybody to bypass all the security controls and get themselves a card or an identity through the system. And the reason that this was so easy to do is the Indian authorities, for some very good reasons, said we can't have a central database that people connect to like you would have in the United States because there isn't good phone connectivity. There isn't good connectivity of any sort out in the villages. So we're going to have to put the smarts in the registration computers, and they're going to have to run some software that we give to anybody who wants to enroll people. And they tried to make sure that you could only enroll from a location that was recognized as an official enrollment center by using GPS signals. And of course, the software just spoofs the right GPS location, no matter where it is. And so this is a very elaborate supply chain attack on a database, not to steal the data, but to create new data that is fake.
Right, and it all comes down to a question of a security hole that was left wide open and driven straight through. Much like, I mean, you and Bruce Schneier discussed the various stories that have come out in the last couple of years about being able to take over a Jeep and control its braking system, or being able to get into a commercial airliner's avionics. It seems to me like those kinds of problems have a common source that maybe from a lawmaking policy standpoint, we need to be paying more attention to, or our lawmakers do.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although the lesson here in some ways is that, you know, there's a tendency to say bad security is the result of people doing dumb things. And I'm not convinced that's the case. It's the result of people doing things that make sense from their mission without fully thinking about how attackers might be able to subvert it. There was a very rational reason for making sure that for giving people software to run to do enrollments and not to rely on a central database. And they tried to protect against this kind of an attack. They just didn't reckon on how sophisticated the attackers might be in their effort to subvert the system. And that's why it's so hard to get good security, because people who are doing their job and doing it in good faith and reasonably competently usually can't foresee really sophisticated attacks.
Right. And I guess just to push back on myself, lawmakers certainly can't foresee them. So, Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really good analysis of like what is actually leading to the problems. And so some of the, you know, the more innovative things that you're doing to solve real world problems are going to make things more or less vulnerable. But yeah, I thought it was really, you know, it's sad for India because, you know, having the ability to have information about their population and get better data about health and economics is ultimately good for a country. And so, you know, I hope that they are able to patch this, you know, not to make a joke of the patch, but, you know, patch the mispatched system and move forward and be able to aggregate that data and make better population decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. Stefan, any thoughts?
It's interesting to me that progress relies to a large degree on being able to implement technologies at scale and in doing so quickly and with sensitive information at hand, there are going to be compromises. And it seems that every time there's a problem, whether it's a hack or some other security issue, that there's not a clear way to message it to the people who've been harmed by it other than to say, oops, we'll do better next time. And I wonder if there isn't a use to be found in explaining to people, you know, why it's worth it anyway, why these setbacks are blips in a process that over time is going to deliver better results. Because I think there's a genuine risk of losing people and losing the messaging battle on why improved, highly scalable technologies are going to ultimately improve people's lives over time. And if every time there's a setback, we have a discussion about privacy issues that is a little bit muddled, I wonder if we aren't going to harm progress in the long run. And I don't mean to minimize the negative consequences here. It's just we can, I think, predict that we're never going to perfectly resolve these problems. And the more information we try to gather in databases and analyze using computers, the more valuable items we create for hackers to try to steal. And I've never been particularly impressed by the ability of the people who are working on that process to articulate why those setbacks shouldn't hinder progress. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of discussion of it. And I found it interesting that it's a sort of ad hoc process when, in fact, it's such a central part of the direction in which advanced societies are heading. So I wonder if there isn't some value in trying to think about this and presenting a justification for why these setbacks aren't ultimately a reason to not plow ahead.
Yeah, where it's consumer technology, I think people see the value, right? Nobody has gotten off of Google's traffic warnings or their navigation systems because they're afraid of having their location information available in a database because it's so convenient. You can see the value, and the privacy loss is pretty theoretical, and the risk of hacking is pretty theoretical. So where consumers can actually see the benefit, I think they've all voted with their feet. Less clear when you're talking about government stuff, because it's that becomes a political battle pretty quickly. And if there are benefits, they often can't be seen very, very easily.
Stuart, one question on this before we move on. We were talking about how states are patting themselves on the back by rolling back their reliance on technology in their voting systems. Do you see that moving into the consumer realm as well, where maybe auto manufacturers and refrigerator manufacturers may start coming to the public and saying, this is not an internet-connected device, and that's a good thing? What do you think?
My guess is we may see that in the Internet of Things. We haven't seen it yet, partly because it's practically free. You don't notice it in the price to have an internet connection for your refrigerator. And even if you don't want it, you're kind of stuck with it. It's a feature. It's a feature they'll say, oh, you don't use it then. But at some point, there's going to be a hack that uses that, that harms not somebody else with a DDoS attack, but actually infiltrates into a network and starts man-in-the-middling your financial transactions or something of this sort. And then I think you could imagine people going around and doing their hardware upgrades with a ball-peen hammer.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we'll see if that all pans out. In the meantime, I'm going to give you our first MCLE password for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show in case you are watching or listening for professional credit in your field, which might be the legal field, might be another field. If you are a lawyer in the U.S., if you head on over to our wiki, shoot, I know I have a short URL for this and I still haven't written it down. But if you do go over to Twit's wiki, wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there. There's a CLE credit page there that has information about how you might go about applying for credit in your jurisdiction. Our first phrase for this show is going to be InfoSec is hard. We'll give you another phrase as we move along through the show. We're happy to help you and support you if you are seeking continuing legal education credit or other credit for watching or listening to the show.
It's twit.to/MCLE.
There we go. Thank you, Victor. twit.to/MCLE. That's much easier to find. All right. So we're going to move on to a story. We've been talking about terrorists and other threats, and we're going to discuss something that actually impacts that and social media. So we got word from the EU on a couple of important things this week. The first one we're going to discuss is a proposal that was submitted on Wednesday expanding the European Commission's guideline from March that relates to illegal content on social media platforms and what social media platforms have to do, according to the European Commission, once they're alerted to the fact that this kind of content is present. And the proposal that they've offered this week wants social media platforms to be eliminating any sort of terrorist organizing activity from their platforms within an hour of having been given notice of such activity. It's interesting to think about, you know, what that means for these platforms. Much like the GDPR, the platforms have to comply with directives of the European Union and the European Commission if they hope to do business with European residents. So what may wind up happening here is that this becomes a platform-wide step that they have to take, because certainly they're not going to do this just for people in the EU and not for people elsewhere around the world. That just doesn't seem practically feasible. But what also may not be practically feasible is having that kind of response time to these kinds of threats. What do you think, Stuart?
So this has been Europe's approach to the web generally, is to find somebody they hate, usually an American social media or tech company, and then to say, you solve it. And if you don't solve it, we're going to charge you 4% of your gross worldwide revenue. There are some predictable problems with this. The most obvious is there is no incentive on the part of the platforms to say, well, wait a minute, maybe this isn't terrorist speech. Because if they leave it up and it turns out it's terrorist speech, they're going to pay a massive amount of money. If they take it down and it wasn't terrorist speech, they get a complaint that is answered by a script.
Right. It's a little bit like the way the DMCA operates for content providers. They're going to comply with a notice to take it down and deal with the fallout afterwards. Stefan, do you think this is even feasible?
No, I don't. I'm not even.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to begin on how not feasible this is. It seems like grandstanding to me. But I wish them luck in articulating a way to build an architecture around this, because if they can pull that off, it'll be an object lesson for a lot of people going forward.
So the European Union has written reports, or people in the European Union have written reports on the progress that Facebook and Google and others have made in taking down terrorist content. And if I remember right, they said 70% of it was taken down within an hour, which makes you think that if you're a regulator, that maybe 100% is within reach. I think that's the problem, is that the first 70% was a lot easier than the last 30%. But they have found ways to do this. There are tells in the metadata, in the connections, in the author that allow you to flag stuff. And I'm confident that they have hired a bunch of outsourcers in Sri Lanka and the Philippines and a variety of other places that can do actual manual checks of a lot of this stuff. So they're going to do okay, but they're never going to get 100% of it in an hour.
Well, and it really depends on how it's set up, right? Do they have to take down – are they flagged by one of the European countries that there is a terrorist piece in there, and they have to take that piece down within the hour? Or do they have to take down everyone that's copied that or something like that? Right? If it's just the – if all the regulation said is that you just got to take down the one link or the one central node of that link, then that's not technically that difficult. I think that there's an exemption for companies under 50 employees or something like that. And so, like, within an hour to take down that, like, that's as long as you have the process in place, that's not that hard. If it's without notice, then you're going to have a really hard time doing that.
That's the problem. It is without notice. There's a certain amount of arm waving and nerd hardering engagement here on the part of the Europeans. They say, "Well, we've set the standard. You figure out how to do it." And after some of the terrorist attacks in Europe, the temperature blaming social media for allowing people to talk on social media that was tied to these attacks was unbelievably harsh. I think the big Silicon Valley companies have responded to that, realizing that they simply can't say the things they would say here, which is, come on, this is not really feasible, or why don't you identify it and then we'll take it down. None of that was flying. And so they have had to develop algorithms and hire staff to look for this stuff. It's just that we don't know all the damage that will be done by this effort to take down the content, including if you take it down, you can't figure out who's actually posting it in many cases. You can't figure out who's exploiting it, retweeting it, and the like. And often your ability to identify people who are doing that is part of the effort to root out terrorist groups inside a particular country's territory.
Oh, that's a really good point. So you think that some national security folks in Washington are probably just slapping themselves on the head about this right now, going, "What are you thinking, EU?"
I do think that is the case. It's a longstanding debate between the people who want to take stuff down and the people who want to exploit it. There's that old a saying about a criminal behavior that or spies, FBI wants to string them up and the CIA wants to string them along. there's a lot to be said for stringing them along for a while.
Right. All right. So that's not the only thing that has been going on in the EU that affects the internet. Let's move on and talk about copyright. If you have teenagers, you may find them paying attention to tech policy this week, because among other things, the EU Parliament voted in a proposal, I believe, again, it was Wednesday, whereby memes are no longer protected online, and various other copyright ramifications too. In fact, let's just go through the list of what we're looking at here. They voted in favor of upload filters, so that social media platforms are supposed to be running everything that gets uploaded against the equivalent of content ID in YouTube, something that is a matching program, that if something's being uploaded and it matches something that's been designated as copyrighted, that it has to be blocked. It voted in favor of link taxes that involve linking to news stories with headlines that include more than a single word of the article's headline. There's a whole licensing regime in there whereby the European Parliament wants folks to obtain licenses from news agencies before they can link to an entire headline. There is a whole aspect that relates to sports and sporting events, photos and videos from sporting events. There is a whole aspect that relates to raising the royalties from streaming services. Here's the meme thing. They voted against a user-generated content exemption that would have allowed small excerpts from works that are used to make memes and other things that are transformative, satirical, etc., and on and on. So this is a big deal for use of the internet. It is not final yet. It is not supposed to take effect, I believe, until 2021. It has various other processes to go through where it can be revised and fine-tuned. But this was the statement of the EU Parliament. So it's looking like this is what they want to implement. It did pass narrowly, though. So I'm presuming that a lot of people are going to be up in arms about this, and that we might see something that looks different in 2021 when this finally gets implemented. What do you think, Stefan?
So, I don't know enough about who's in the European Parliament now to say that the statement is still true. But let me start with a premise that would have been true a few years ago. And that's even within European countries, I don't think people take the European Parliament and the people who constitute it particularly seriously. I think the turnout is very low for those elections. It's not the best and the brightest who end up in that situation. And this legislation, I think, reflects that to some degree. I don't think it's particularly thoughtful, and I don't think it takes into account the ripple effects that it's going to cause if it's in fact ever put into practice and enforced. So I think this, again, to use the same term again, it sort of suggests a certain amount of grandstanding and a certain amount of virtue signaling, if you will, by the European Parliament on where their priorities are and what's important to them. I don't think it's a serious piece of legislation that has taken into account every or even, the most basic policy consequences of its implementation. So it's not, I just don't see it as a thoughtful piece of legislation at all. And I would be surprised if it ever were put into practice.
What do you think, Stuart?
I agreed. You could have said the same thing about the very aggressive data protection regulation that was adopted, GDPR. It took forever to work its way through all of the processes, and people kept expecting it to get more reasonable, and it never did. And now it's law. So I expect this to take effect in part because every time some attack on one provision or another is mounted, I think you can guarantee that the copyright interests, the content providers, are going to be aggressively lobbying and watching at every step of the way to make sure that their provisions are preserved. So it might change, but it might change it to become more aggressive and not less. And my big regret is that Leo is out this week, because this would give him another chance to froth at the mouth about the way the algorithms that YouTube uses to find infringing content are constantly taking down his episodes because he played three bars of a commercial. That's the kind of thing that the EU has really voted for, I think.
Matt, do you think that this is going to get implemented in its current form or changed, or what do you think its impact will be?
I have no idea about parliamentary procedure of the European Union, but mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting in terms of a grandstanding that of protections, and it kind of relates to the structural differences in our economies. Is that their protections specifically take copyrights in the instance of someone at a football game or a European football game, and gives them to the sporting leagues. And if there's anyone who's good for corruption, it's always FIFA. And it just seems like they've got this in the copyright protection, that they're taking the copyrights from the individuals and giving it to the sporting league. But more structurally, I think that when you see we're talking about a global world of the internet, and much of the economic power in this global world, especially in search, especially in more of these technologies that are 10 years ago. And I know that Spotify got a little bit roped into this, which is a European country, but all of this is the United States. So any detriment that they're giving economically to any company is not hurting their citizens in a lot of ways. So there's not as much from their perspective, there's not as much give and take. It's just take more rights for, they have music producers and video producers in Europe. And so they're just taking money and giving it to their constituents. So I think, in terms of structurally what's going to get passed, I could see something that benefits, local producers or at least in theory benefits local producers over, the YouTubes or the Googles or Facebooks in the world being passed.
I once tried to persuade a French national security official not to do something that would have had a major impact on the internet economy. And I said, boy, if you do this, it could end up in France getting cut off from the internet. And he said, mm-hmm. Well, there must be a disadvantage too.
Yes, back to disconnecting our refrigerators and washers and dryers. Maybe that's what the EU has in mind here. I do think that this is going to mobilize a whole lot of people who didn't know that this was happening, particularly people outside the EU who don't pay attention to what the EU is doing on a daily basis, but now are going to face the fallout of how companies have to comply with this and are not going to like it one bit. I think that it's very detrimental for creative people, as Stuart alluded to have not just one video platform, but every online distribution platform subject to a law that says they have to run everything against a copyright database. And the population of that copyright database is fraught with controversy and problem in its own right. I think we're going to see a lot of people push back on this and attempt to undo what the EU Parliament has done. Whether that will be effective or not remains to be seen, but I think the fallout of this is just going to begin. You can guarantee, too, that all of the political clout of the companies impacted, as you point out, Matt, will be brought to bear against this too, because this is going to be not just hard on them, but hard on users of the internet. Think just about the news piece. The ability to find relevant news is going to be vastly impacted by this. And, you know, presumably the EU Parliament is thinking, well, people will just buy these licenses and it will all be fine. And I don't think that companies are going to go quietly into that good night at all. There's a lot still to come on this front, but we wanted to raise it this week in case you are one of those people who was unaware that the EU had been up to this and now is going to have to face the fallout. Any final thoughts, Stuart?
Nope.
All right. Anybody else?
I think the counterexample to that the companies won't do this is obviously the Chinese market. You know, the Chinese government tells us that we have to have specific rules for what content can even be seen. And, you know, that's, you know, Google operates under those parameters. Facebook operates under those parameters. So there is counterexamples of where, you know, companies choose to operate within these conditions and essentially take on services that they wouldn't have otherwise taken on, and you know, they continue to operate there.
All right.
I do think, go ahead. I'll say this. I think there is a real risk that the link tax thing will backfire. It's already backfired in Spain. The Germans tried it and it backfired on them because Google just started finding headlines from some other location and giving the traffic to people who didn't insist on the tax. And I would not be surprised. It's not that hard to run a news bureau. And you can run a news bureau in German outside of Germany. And if there's no tax on your headlines and there is a tax on German headlines, I think Google's likely to start feeding the news to somebody in South Africa who speaks pretty good German.
Oh, sure. That's an excellent point. And it's an excellent opportunity for less incumbent news organizations to find a way to compete with those that are. Not just be good, but don't insist on that tax. All right. Let us move on to discuss current developments in legislation, regulation, and policy. All right, let's talk about cybersecurity and cyber attacks a bit, Stuart. I'm curious about the new administrative policy that was enacted in August that has to do with penetrating our own systems, penetrating other systems, et cetera, et cetera. Can you help us unpack this and understand what it means?
Yeah, this policy change, I think it was PPD 20, they called it. It was an Obama-era rule that was just rules of the road for making government decisions about when we're going to use cyber weapons in a conflict, declared or undeclared. You know, are we going to attack an ISIS website, or are we going to string them along? The famously, of course, according to the press, the United States and Israel used Stuxnet to try to cripple the Iranian nuclear power program, and did set it back about a year. And the question that has arisen is, when should tools like that be used, and who gets a say before they're used? And the Obama administration had written rules that essentially said, if you're in government and you have a pulse, you get to participate in these decisions. The Commerce Department said, well, we care because we represent business and business could be harmed by this. A variety of other agencies weighed in because they wanted to be heard on broad policy issues, which meant that it was very hard to get consensus to do anything using cyber weapons. The Trump administration, in almost every aspect of military oversight, has said, consistent with President Trump's view of the world, I trust the generals. We'll give them the authority. They'll do it right. And if they don't do it right, I can always fire them. Essentially what this new revised order does, it hasn't been published, it's classified, is streamline the process for the Defense Department using cyber weapons, allowing Cyber Command to attack adversaries with its weapons without having the Commerce Department wring its hands in the process. It probably was inevitable. I think even Hillary Clinton's administration would have changed this. The Obama administration was uniquely tied up in interagency debates. And if you want to do something in the end, you have to end those debates. And my guess is actually even a third term for President Obama would have seen some changes here. How big the changes are, we don't know for sure. And we will find out over time as various Cyber Command attacks come to light and the process is explored. But for now, I think it may have gotten actually a little more coverage than it deserved.
Okay. This is actually what I had in mind a bit when we were talking about election security, is whether this order allows or gives more latitude for the U.S. to respond in kind to hacking or meddling in our elections.
It probably means that in more cases than in the past, those decisions will be made at the Pentagon and not in the White House, because it delegates more responsibility there, and that more attacks of that kind by the U.S. will become routinized, things that have happened before and nobody is upset about. So they're going to be part of the military toolbox for the future.
So in that context, we talked about hacking back, which apparently isn't, as you say, the U.S. government. This is a different phenomenon where if a private corporate entity gets hacked, presently it's illegal for them to take offensive countermeasures, but that could change?
Of course, the U.S. government does hack back and has hacked back on Putin for his election interference in ways that we haven't heard about entirely. But retribution on the part of government is common. The problem, as I see it, and I am I'm on the edge of this controversy, is the people who see data stolen from their networks, that see intrusions in the physical world. There are cops on the beat. There are 911 calls that go to the police when something happens, and they can show up at the scene of the crime. None of that happens in cyberspace. That is all entirely privatized within the company. And so you can call the police to help you when you're hacked, but the amount of time you'll spend briefing them and trying to make sure they understand the environment and the nature of the crime and the attacker means that the guy will get away before the police can do anything. And so it seems to me that the current U.S. law that says you have to stay in your network or it's a felony needs some rethinking. It's not like that law, which has been around for 30 years, has produced security nirvana. The question is, what should you be able to do outside of your network? And here, I think there's a lot of effort on the part of people who don't want to change the law to say, well, this is an effort to allow people to fire missiles back at attackers, to take down whole infrastructures because they've been attacked from that infrastructure, and to do a bunch of stupid things, which I don't think anybody's really advocating. But allowing somebody to get out of their network to find out who's attacking them, to follow the stolen goods to a command and control server, I think that's worth thinking about. It's got to be supervised. It's got to be something where the company that does it reports it and is responsible for having caused harm if it does it in a bad way. But the system we have today isn't working. The resources are all in the hands of the private sector. And if we want to do a better job of attribution, we ought to encourage private companies to do more private attribution.
Is it the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that bars companies doing this now, or is it something else?
It's the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which was written basically to say, if you do something without authority on a network, gather information, change data, et cetera, that's a felony in most cases. The only way to be sure that you're acting with authority is to do it on your own network or a network where the owner has given you permission. And obviously, if you're trying to find your stuff on somebody's command and control center, the hackers are not going to give you permission. Going there, using the same credentials they used when they stole your stuff and stored it on this command and control center, something you could do within 10 seconds if you're a company who sees the loss, and within 3 days if you're law enforcement and lucky, is potentially valuable because you have the possibility of recovering or re-encrypting your data while it sits there and thwarting the crime. But the only people who are going to be able to do that in real time are the victims of the crime.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Stefan, any thoughts?
This is a great area where I think having a public debate informed by expertise is important. And it sounds like a lot of this is subject to confidential directives and things that are being leaked into the press and then reported about sort of secondhand in that way. And that's unfortunate because I think the public deserves to know what the inputs are into the decision-making process here, since it's going to impact everybody who uses any kind of technology that is liable to get hacked. And so I'll have to take the experts at their word that this is something that wasn't working well in the past and needs to be updated. I just hope that that debate happens in the light of day and not behind closed doors, because it has such a broad impact and certainly sounds like something that has a potential to spiral out of control if it's not smartly regulated. I think empowering private actors to essentially act as mercenaries isn't necessarily wise unless it's done under circumstances that are carefully regulated with expertise in mind. So I hope that the next phase of this happens in a way that allows public comment and input and that the experts articulate their best position and we have a deliberative process that results in wonderful legislation. And that's my optimistic Pollyannish hope for this.
Yes, and for every other bit of legislation we enact.
There is a bill pending in Congress that's gotten, you know, a fair number of co-sponsors, called the ACDC Act, that would do some of this. And it's getting a lot of debate. I calling them mercenaries is not necessarily inaccurate, but that's not what we would call a private investigator who's playing much the same role, who's regulated but allowed to do a certain amount of regulatory activity that or investigative activity that ordinary citizens aren't trusted to do, just as repo men are entrusted with that authority. We have a lot of people like this in the physical world, and we've learned to regulate them in ways that minimize the harm and maximize the ability of people who really are motivated to get their stuff back to do that.
Most prominently, Han Solo, one of the intergalactic bounty hunters. In power under the circumstances. So.
Yes. Question for you, Stuart, about the structure that was in place before under the Obama administration that was altered by, is it PPD 20 that did the altering or that was altered?
PPD 20 is the old one. I'm not sure.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about PPD 20 for a second. Was the logic there that there was some sort of oversight role to be played by the Commerce Department and other agencies that had a say under that regime that no longer get to participate in these decisions?
I think there were two things going on. First, it was a new set of tools, a new set of weapons that were being used, and not everybody understood. Most people didn't understand. Maybe nobody understood exactly what the implications would be. And so being cautious and making sure that every use got a careful scrub made some sense early on. Also, once you let somebody into a process, especially if it's got high security clearances, they never want to leave. And so there was a lobby to say, I want to sit at the table. I want to continue to sit at the table. And it would have taken an act of will by President Obama to say, no, you're not going to be able to sit at the table anymore. And that would have been particularly difficult after Snowden, where the use of Stuxnet and other weapons was part of the effort to hurt U.S. industry because of the acts of the U.S. government. And so it was not implausible for the Commerce Department to say we have a dog in this fight. But to have them making decisions about the military deployments, especially the third decision of the same sort, I think started to grate on the Pentagon. Understandably, they feel once they've made a decision, they have to do something. They have to do it fast, and they can't spend too much time waiting for Washington to give them the okay sign. That's a traditional fight between the field and the center. And their feeling was the center was particularly sclerotic because of this interagency process.
Okay. Question two about the CFAA, which has come up in this discussion. I take it from your comments you would be a proponent of reforming it or doing away with it?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would do away with it, but it's... ironically, people complain about how laws don't reflect the changing technology. This is a law that's been around since 85 or so. And by choosing something as general and abstract as are you acting without authority, they managed to pick a principle that remains lively and relevant to the question of what people should and shouldn't do on in cyberspace. So I wouldn't get rid of it, but I do think we need to rethink the question of where we want the efforts of the private sector to stop. And of course, we don't want them to be firing weapons, but the idea of giving them more authority I think could make a big difference in our cybersecurity. You know, I think JP Morgan alone spends more on cybersecurity for itself than DHS spends for the entire civilian sector of government and the private sector. The resources are in the private sector, and if we want to see innovation and aggressive use of tools that we are comfortable with, we're going to have to let the private sector play because the public sector is never going to have the resources to do a lot of this.
Yeah, that's a staggering thing to think about what you just mentioned there. What is your take on the momentum in Congress, which has a lot of other things it's worried about right now, for reforming the CFAA?
So there are a lot of different CFAA reforms that people have been thinking about. There's a lot of energy around the question of whether it should be a violation of federal law to break the rules that a particular site has set for it for users, that's been a EFF campaign that has never gone anywhere, resulting from Schwartz's suicide and prosecution and the harsh penalties that were proposed for him, and the woman in Southern California who pretended to be a kid and suggested suicide to one of the other one of the enemies of her daughter, and the kid actually did commit suicide, and that was also prosecuted ultimately unsuccessfully because of it was a violation of I think Facebook's rules. So that's and that's worth thinking about. It is a kind of it's a privatization of law too, to say whatever rules the site has, we're going to make them federal laws and back them up with felony prosecutions. So that's worth thinking about. And I think in the context I'm talking about, I would just add a provision that allows people to go to the Justice Department with plans for doing things outside their network that they think would improve cybersecurity, and getting approval for it, or allowing trusted private security firms to do certain things, such as follow stolen property at least one hop away from their network. There's a variety of things that could be done. I would be cautious here because we don't know how far it will go. But it seems to me, at a minimum, we ought to allow the Justice Department and encourage the Justice Department to be much more flexible about telling people what they can do. This is a little like the EU problem, where if you tell somebody, if you screw this up, we'll take 4% of your global gross revenue from you. If you screw it up in one direction, if you screw it up in the other direction, nothing bad happens. Well, telling people it's a felony to do it wrong in one direction, to step outside your network, even for the best of reasons, means that people are not going to do it even for the best of reasons.
All right. Well, we find ourselves here closing in on the end of our show with two incredibly meaty issues left to discuss. So let's do our best with at least touching on them. The first is FISA and the fact that there is a Second Circuit case that is pending now called U.S. versus Haz Bajrami that challenges the constitutionality of surveillance under FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Stuart, I wonder if you've been paying attention to this case. I believe oral argument just happened and we don't have a decision in it yet. But if you could tell us what it's about and what you think is likely to happen here.
Sure. And we don't know all the facts because many of the facts are classified, which is sort of one of the problems with the case. Mm-hmm. But it is a challenge to what's called the 702 program, which everyone, even people who are skeptical about it, admits has been enormously effective from a counterterrorism point of view. And it essentially allows the government to wiretap or collect communications of a targeted person believed to be associated with terrorism, reasonably suspected of terrorism, even if the communications have a connection to the United States. So the most obvious example would be if I'm running a terrorist plot and I'm in Spain and I'm dealing with terrorists in Colombia, there's a good chance that that communication goes through through Miami, and so the United States might say, "We know there's a terrorist in Colombia, and he's up to something. We want to see any communications that go to or from him, and we're going to intercept them in Miami." And the other circumstance, even more obvious, is two Colombian terrorists plotting with each other using Hotmail. And that means that all of their communications go through the United States, and the United States wants to be able to go to Microsoft and say, these guys are terrorists, here are their accounts, tell us what they're saying. Because there's a connection to the United States, the assumption has been that there needs to be a lot of law built around that. And Congress has passed laws several times now to authorize that kind of intercept. The controversial issue seems to be as follows. Once you've collected those communications, there's a decent chance that in that email that's sent to that guy in Colombia is going to be email from Americans, and that's going to get picked up in the intercept as well. The question is, should there be a warrant before you can collect Americans' communications when they're dealing with a foreign terrorist? Or even maybe more pointedly, if you collect all that information about people talking to this foreign terrorist, you put it in a database, you either act against the terrorist or you don't, but you still have the data in the database. And the FBI is later investigating an American and wants to ask this database, by the way, did he ever talk to a terrorist outside the United States? The argument is, well, now you're searching for an American and you need a warrant. And that's the argument that was made in the context of this case. That argument's been rejected by FISA court judges and I think the Ninth Circuit, but we'll see what the Second Circuit says. I haven't gotten a good readout on what the questions were at the oral argument. My guess is they didn't tell us much about which way the court is leaning, or we'd already have heard. But that's the debate.
Got it. Matt, did you take a look at this at all?
Yeah, I just thought it was, you know, a really fascinating look at, you know, someone who's not familiar with how these things typically happened. But you know, a real question of, you know, the ability to collect this information and then to store it and search it and see how it's used. And I believe that a similar use was used before President Trump was inaugurated on the Russia investigation. So the legality of that seems to speak to this. But yeah, just, you know, in just, there was an interesting constitutional argument that, you know, the search and seizure clause that search essentially meant what we mean as modern day search, which clearly is not applicable. But I think it's, you know, it's probably a policy question of whether we should be doing this more than a constitutional question, because it doesn't seem like, you know, any sense of historical practice of searching and seizure. You know, if for instance, if I you know, if I committed a murder and left my gun at, you know, my friend's house, and that friend had a search of their home and that gun turned up, then it seems logical that the you know, the police can use that against me later. Although, you know, they may not have been able to search my house because they didn't have probable cause or something. So it seems like the analogy would fit there too. If you didn't have the right to search me, but you searched through communications of someone else who I was in correspondence with, and you had the right to have that, then you would have the right to search that later too. But I think it's a really, you know, I think it's a really interesting policy question of whether we want that. I would assume that they're going to come out in favor of the government here.
I think you've got it. You hit the nail on the head, Matt. This is a policy issue, and it's always been treated as separate from law enforcement, probably because, you know, in the worst case, if a murderer goes free, well, there could be another murder. But if a spy is able to get away with the secret of the atomic bomb and take it to the Soviet Union, as happened, it puts millions, tens of millions of people's lives at risk, or you could lose wars. And so there's been an assumption that we have to be able to be much more aggressive in dealing with national security threats than with ordinary criminal threats. And that's the source of the enthusiasm for continuing to approach this problem more aggressively.
Okay, Stefan, any thoughts or anything you want to add?
I do have a narrow question for Stuart, because, you know, on some level, of course, this is a policy question, but there's also an underlying legal structure here that's implicated. And one of the very specific issues that this decision is going to address is the incidental overhear doctrine. And this is outside my area of expertise, but my understanding of the incidental overhear doctrine and its operation in this context is the government essentially argues that because they have the right to listen in on these conversations for non-Americans, so for instance, if there's a call happening from the U.S. to Pakistan, as was the case in this particular case, there's no Fourth Amendment right that the Pakistani participant has in having the government stay out of their conversation, and therefore the government can listen in. And the way that the incidental overhear doctrine works there is that because the government has no Fourth Amendment bar to listening in on the Pakistani part of the conversation, then they can listen to the American as well as an incidental piece of that wiretapping. But my understanding of the incidental overhear doctrine and its general application is that it applies in situations where there's an underlying warrant to begin with. So, for instance, if following the issuance of a warrant, investigators overhear or learn some fact, in connection with that investigation, they're allowed to use that fact because it's incidental to the underlying investigation. But that presumes that there was a warrant. Now, in this case, there's no need for a warrant, and therefore, does the incidental overhear doctrine really apply, or is this an attempt by the government to use a warrantless procedure to sort of, you know, go after what they really care about, which is the American side of things? So I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that particular doctrine as it's applied in the circumstance where there is no underlying warrant to rely on.
Sure. I think it's this is a clever framing on the part of the civil libertarians, and I think it's probably wrong to focus on the warrant requirement popping up in multiple places. What really has happened here, I think, with 702 is people said, don't you need a warrant to get the communication of that guy overseas? And for obvious policy reasons, no one wanted to impose that requirement on national security wiretaps. And so they went to the courts with an analysis that said, we're actually not required to get a warrant by the Constitution. The ground requirement is that the search be reasonable. And if the search is reasonable, then in many cases you don't need a warrant. And the court said, yes, okay, show us that this is a reasonable search. And in order to persuade the court that it was a reasonable search, the government said, well, first we require probable or a reasonable suspicion of someone being a terrorist. And then we have protections for what is done with the data that is collected, which might include a requirement that there be a good reason to search the collected database. So that's the reasonableness requirement. The warrant idea is to say, well, no, anytime you search for an American's data, you need to have a warrant in principle. I'm not sure that's true as a matter of law. And the countervailing argument that the government would make is we've already collected this lawfully. The government, the courts looked at our plan for this data, our plan for the intercept, and concluded that it was overall reasonable. That doesn't change because we're doing a search for a particular American's name. The data plan overall is reasonable. And if you want to argue that it's not, that's fine. We can have that discussion. And maybe the courts will say, no, there needs to be some oversight of searches for Americans. But there's no obligation to topple over into requiring warrants. Because I think at the end of the day, you're more likely to analyze this as a matter of reasonableness than as a matter of applying a warrant requirement to data that the government already has control of.
So if I could just add one more follow-on question with you having made that point. Is it foreseeable then that as the technology advances and the ability to gather and process data at a faster rate increases and more information about people is pushed into digital formats, do you see this as imperiling the Fourth Amendment at all? Because if what it sounds like you're saying is that as long as the initial gathering of information satisfies the reasonableness standards and has a national security component, then any subsequent searches of that data can be handled by that same reasonableness standard and don't actually implicate the Fourth Amendment. So if we get to a point where we can gather all communications by all Americans that have any kind of connection to national security, have we at that point forfeited our Fourth Amendment rights to communicate digitally because of that underlying national security question? And so I'm not saying that confrontationally, yeah. But just as a framework, to try to understand the legal framework here, is that really where we are right now with the law, where as long as the underlying search has the national security component, any downstream searches can therefore be made as long, pursuant to that same standard?
Broadly, you're not wrong. It's just that I would say that the number of conversations, the amount of data that anyone is interested in for national security purposes is a surprisingly small segment of communications. And it would be, in my experience, when you search for something, you get stuff that's relevant to what you're searching, and it's useless for any other purpose, including the idea of monitoring the behavior of ordinary people or finding ordinary crimes. So it would be a waste of time and effort, even if you were a truly evil person, to say, I'm going to start looking for my political enemies' conversations in these databases, because these are conversations with a random assortment of terrorist plotters around the world. If your enemies are engaged in substantial conversations with those folks, then they probably have more to worry about than your political vendetta. I think that's a practical answer to this. But if you wanted to impose legal strictures, the reasonableness doctrine is broad enough that the court could say, in response to a plausible concern, we think there needs to be some additional protection on the second search or the third search or the fourth search of that data. The problem and the reason that hasn't happened is you have to imagine that you're an FBI agent who's doing a background check on somebody who suddenly has shown up with a Facebook post that seems to be favorable to domestic attacks, and you say, who is this guy and do we have to worry about them? You want to run him through as many databases that might tell you whether you should be worried about him as possible. And if you have to stop about one and say, wait a minute, should I get a warrant for that? You probably aren't going to run it. And there's a real risk at that point that the U.S. government will know this guy is dangerous because of data that it has in its files, and it won't check it because we've made it too hard for the guy who's actually responsible for making that check to do the job.
You did an op-ed on this a while back about your testimony before the 9/11 Commission and yeah. The walls between government agencies and right hand not knowing what left hand is doing. And I think it's such a hard question because obviously these Fourth Amendment issues are foundational to our values as a nation. And obviously security and preventing terrible violent acts is foundational as well. So it's really hard to strike that balance. I'm wondering, just as a follow-up to Stefan's question, we have a couple of write-ups of this case by Elizabeth. Actually, they're by two different folks. Elizabeth Goetine, possibly, is how you pronounce her last name. And Sharon Bradford Franklin at a blog called Just Security. And one of the points made there is this notion of targeting being brought into Fourth Amendment jurisprudence for the first time as the justification to basically trigger that reasonableness standard as sufficient to alleviate the need for a warrant. And I wonder what your thoughts are there and whether you think the Second Circuit, in deciding this case, may, as an alternative, put in some safeguards that, again, you may have some trepidation about, but if you think that way, that may be the way the court decides to resolve this.
They could. I both Elizabeth and Sharon are committed civil libertarians and less enthusiastic about national security justifications, and that's what their blog posts reflect. I think, you know, somebody once said, if you want to be, if you can think about two things that are intimately related and talk about them without ever connecting them, then you have a mind, the mind of a lawyer. And I think there's a little bit of that in these posts. We've had wiretap laws for 50 years, and the wiretap laws say once you decide what phone you're tapping, you have to show that there's somebody using that phone that is your target. And once you've decided that, the fact that other people are using the phone, this sort of dates us all, because now the phones are very personal, but they used to just be utilities sitting in the hall, and everybody in the family used the same phone, and so did the guy who came to fix your furnace. If the father in the family was in the mob and was a target, then everybody who used that phone was listened to. And no one said, well, you need a warrant to listen to the daughter when she asks about her homework and the mom when she orders pizza. It was just assumed, well, that's as a practical matter, that's the only way we can really run our wiretaps. So the fact that the target was justified also justified the additional collection. And then there were restrictions on it. You're supposed to stop if you become convinced that the call has nothing to do with the crime you're investigating and the like. But it was not a warrant requirement. So we're already thoroughly pregnant there. And you have to say, oh, that's really not quite the same as doing a later search of the documents, or it's not the same as keeping the information so that it can be searched. And sure, there's a difference there, but I'm not sure it's a difference that makes the difference between a warrant requirement and not. I just want to say something briefly about my testimony to the 9/11 Commission, because it does explain a lot. I was an enthusiastic proponent of building a wall between law enforcement and intelligence so that we could use strong intelligence capabilities against our national security targets, and they wouldn't infect our law enforcement activities and techniques, because I thought that would be, you know, it could be misused, and that theoretical risk of abuse was enough to say, why don't we make sure that abuse can't happen by building a wall? It seemed like such an obvious idea and was good for privacy, and I didn't see how it would hurt national security, until it turned out that it was so aggressively applied by the FISA court and others that when the FBI, when the CIA and parts of the FBI that were responsible for national security discovered there were terrorists in the United States, these were the hijackers, they were afraid to tell the people who had the ability to do that investigation inside the United States, the law enforcement arm, as well as the national security arm of the FBI. They didn't tell the people who had the resources. They never found the guys, even though they had a couple of weeks to find them. And we know the result. And I felt, frankly, deeply guilty for having advanced, without an abuse to point to, a civil liberties measure that had that impact. And so it's been my resolution for the last 17 years that I'm never going to do that unless there's actually an abuse that we can show we're addressing, and the abuse, the measure to stop it, is not going to prevent us from doing a good job on national security. The stakes are just too high. And that accounts for my absolutely determined opposition to some of what I think are slightly flaky privacy concerns that don't have an actual abuse to address.
Yep, I get your points, and think that this is a particularly hard issue that folks continue to struggle with, no matter, you know, what their emphasis or first priorities are. So we're really glad to have had the opportunity to explore your views on it today, Stuart. I was really hoping to also get into the question of encryption, but we are running out of time here. We need to extract a promise from you right now that we can get you back on the show and talk about encryption and going dark at some later date.
Yes, I'll be glad to do it. And I think I talked to Bruce Schneier a little bit, because it comes up in mm-hmm. his book. So the people can probably predict where I am on that issue. I like to tell my friends who listen to podcasts when they work out that, especially the liberals, they can get their heart rate over 100 without doing anything, just listening.
Absolutely. Yes. No, I do. You're obviously, you've given long and hard thought to these issues, and we have too. And it would be great to have considerably more time than we have right now to go through that tough nut with you. I think that we will make our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. The title of your book, which is Skating on Stilts, that actually happens to be one of our several resources of the week for this show. There is a Creative Commons version of Skating on Stilts if you would be interested in reading Stuart's book. It's available at Stuart's website and blog, which is skatingonstilts.com. And also what's available there is all of the episodes of the Cyber Law podcast, as well as summaries of what's in the episodes. Another wonderful resource of the week for us. I have one more just to toss out there because it caught my eye this week. And just the fact that such a thing exists, I found interesting. It is called Sploitus, S-P-L-O-I-T-U-S. It seemed like a complimentary resource for what we've been discussing this week. It is a search engine that focuses, as you might gather from the title, on various security flaws and exploits. So if you're into looking at what's out there, Sploitus might be a good starting point for you. And then I wanted to do something that we don't usually do on our resources of the week, and have us each go around and, in the interest of time, just give one thing that we look at either to update ourselves on a daily basis on current information, or, you know, I have a bunch of go-tos that I do each week to start to prep the show. And let's start with you, Stefan. What's your great news source that you constantly go back to?
So I'm a big believer in kind of having a mix of high, low, and a healthy dose of middle brow as well. And so for me, New York Magazine manages to sort of strike all those notes. I think they're pretty good at having thoughtful political commentary. They also have great sort of celebrity gossip and summaries of The Bachelor, which are very important to me. And so it's a good mix of high, low, and a lot of middle brow, which is right in my wheelhouse. So New York Magazine, thank you for the work that you do.
That's great. How about you, Matt?
I tend to use my reading is more topical, so I tend to use Google News to source information, I would say in terms of where I just go to see what's going on, I think TechDirt is amazing. I love their both the content that they provide, but also the sort of commentary that they give you is really great.
All right, Stuart.
So I have a whole bunch of Feedly feeds that I pull together. If you're looking for probably the smartest take on some of these issues from the right, it's probably Instapundit. But I agree that Mike Masnick, even though he routinely trashes me, is a great resource on TechDirt. And I guess I would offer as a tool, if you haven't encountered this, anybody who listens to podcasts like this, you occasionally will encounter a video or an audio file that isn't a podcast, you want to listen to it rather than while you're sitting there at your desk, listen to it instead when you're working out. There are a couple of tools with names like HuffDuff and HuffDuff Video, where they'll just sit on your computer in your browser. You click on them, they find the audio or video file, turn it into a podcast, and send it to your podcast feed. It's a great way to consume occasional audio material.
That's great. Instapendent, by the way, for people who aren't familiar, is authored by Glenn Harlan Reynolds. He's a tech law professor at University of Tennessee, I want to say, or some academic institution in Tennessee, and has been knocking around the internet since its very, very early days. Let's see. My own is a new one that I just started looking at this week and happily subscribed to. Someone named Derek Hawkins authors a Cybersecurity 202 newsletter for the Washington Post. And I've only received two issues of it so far, and they are detailed and dense and full of great information. So got to recommend that one. And we'll go through and we'll do more of our go-to news gathering resources on future shows. I love hearing I know what I refer to. I love hearing what our guests do. Let's do our tip of the week very quickly. And our tip would be, should you find your network slowing to a crawl and are looking around for the malware and what may be launching DDoS attacks, we already mentioned that it might be your washing machine or your refrigerator. Apparently, if you're a university in the United States, it might also be all your vending machines. There was a piece that was released by Verizon Enterprise of its last year's Data Breach Digest report. And it had data on a university that preferred to remain anonymous for obvious reasons, that it detailed how it was the vending machines on campus selling soda and food and snacks, et cetera. Over 5,000 of them had been compromised and infected with malware through guest default passwords and were being controlled remotely. So look to the vending machines if you're having a problem. And then, of course, we wouldn't be an episode of This Week in Law if we didn't have a very special This Week Animal Selfie of the Week for you. I told Stuart before the show we were going to have to try to find an animal selfie because he disclaimed any responsibility for coming up with or providing our animal selfie this week. And I told him we'd try and find a cat hacker that was going to unleash holy hell every time it was called a script kitty. And guess what? I found them. This is actually a wonderful compilation of cats who found themselves photographed by their owners' laptops or possibly other computers. They mostly look like the laptop, that were set with a security feature that was designed to take a picture of the person or animal in this case trying to access the computer after three failed password attempts. So all of these kitties, that's what Victor is showing you now, appears to be cat patient zero, the first one that was photographed and put on imgur for attempting this. And then there's a piece at the Daily Mail that has maybe a dozen of these cat pictures of cats trying to hack their owners' computers, but thwarted by the security measure. So Stuart, how'd I do?
Oh, that's great. No, you had me at script kitty.
All right. We have gone a bit late this week, but there was so much good discussion and conversation. Stuart Baker, we just can't thank you enough for spending the time with us today.
It was a great experience, and I'm a longtime fan. I'm thrilled to be on.
We were thrilled to have you. Stefan Spida, wonderful to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Very glad to be back, and thanks for the wonderful topics and conversation. Learn a lot.
Yeah, I did as well. And Matt Curtis, founder of Pareto Life Sciences. How is everything going, Matt? Good in the startup world?
Everything's always wild in the startup world, so that's just the way it goes. But thanks so much for coming on. And just to tell PETA, if Naruto would have been a person for the purposes of the Copyright Act, they also would have been a that those cats would have been a person for the purposes of the CFAA, and they would have been going to jail. So unintended consequences all around.
That's true. Excellent point. All right, everyone, we thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This Week in Law. If you have done so at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, that means you've joined us live. That's when we record the show. And you can go to twit.tv and watch live with us as we record. But as mentioned previously, all of our shows are archived there at twit.tv as well. So you can enjoy the show at your leisure on the device of your choice through the podcast fetching and finding app of your choice. We're just thrilled that you do join us. We're thrilled that you get in touch with us between the shows. Let us know if you have thoughts or opinions about our discussions, further points that you'd like to make, or that you were like rapping on your table saying, yeah, why didn't you guys say this? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Stefan, we hope soon will be Stefan at twit.tv. Are you getting mail there yet, Stefan?
Too much fan. I know. Right?
Yeah. No, not yet. We're still working on Stefan's email. And it may be a firm security issue that is taking good care of Stefan and his law firm's data, but may be preventing our email from working with its system. So we're working through that.
We'll find a patch. We'll get one of the hackers in India to help out, maybe, if they're listening.
Work. Hope springs eternal. And Matt is Matt C at twit.tv. So do reach out to us between the shows. Find us on Twitter. Find us however you can. Let us know what's on your mind and what you think we need to know. We definitely rely on your feedback to get this show done. So we just can't thank you enough for keeping that coming in. And once again, thank you so much to all of you. This has been just a phenomenal episode of the show. I've really enjoyed it. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Until then, take care.